This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Your Second Life Begins When You Realize You Only Have One by Raphael Giordano. Translated from the French by Nick Caister. Read for you by Fiona Hardingham. My dream is that everyone should take full advantage of their talents and responsibility for their happiness, because there is nothing more important than to live life to the limits of one's childhood dreams. Have a good journey. Raphael. 1. The raindrops crashing against my windshield grew larger and larger. The wipers creaked and shuddered, and soon the torrents of water were so great that I instinctively took my foot off the accelerator. It was an almost biblical storm. A car accident was the last thing I needed. To avoid the Friday evening traffic on my way back into central Paris, I had decided to take the back roads through the woods that surround the city. Anything to avoid the gridlocked highways and the horror of spending hours at a standstill. I squinted as I tried to make out the road signs ahead through the misted up windows. And as if the weather and the traffic weren't enough, all of a sudden, in the middle of the dark wood, my GPS gave up the ghost. It has to be said, no GPS would ever have survived the journey I'd just made, or at least not unscathed. I was returning from an uncharted wilderness, the sort of area where you are here means you are nowhere. And yet, out there was a small office park, an unlikely collection of PLCs, profitless companies, I thought to myself, that my boss must have thought offered enough of a commercial opportunity to justify my trip. Although I had the unpleasant suspicion that ever since he'd agreed I could work a 4-day week, he was making me pay for that favor by giving me the jobs no one else wanted, which explained why I was in this tin can on wheels, navigating the roads on the outskirts of Paris to chase after such small fry.
Come on, Camille. Stop feeling sorry for yourself and concentrate on the road.
Suddenly, there was a loud bang. I swerved terrifyingly out of control. My head hit the windshield, and I learned that the story about your life flashing in front of your eyes in a split second wasn't just a myth. After a few foggy moments, I came to and tentatively reached up to where I'd hit my forehead. Nothing sticky, thank goodness. Just a large bump. I quickly checked myself all over. No other injuries to report. More of a fright than anything else, thank God. I got out of the car, shielding myself from the rain as best I could with my raincoat, and went to inspect the damage, a burst tire and a dented fender. Once I got over my initial panic, fear gave way to anger. For fuck's sake, could today possibly get any worse? With shaking hands, I grabbed my cell phone as if it was a lifeline. No signal, of course. Why was I not surprised? The minutes ticked by. Nothing. There wasn't a soul around. I was all alone, stranded in this empty wood.
Don't just panic. Do something. There must be people living around here somewhere.
So, I abandoned the car. It was no use to me now, and set off along the road, braving the elements in my oh-so-glamorous high-vis waterproof. Needs must. After an eternity of 10 minutes, I came across the iron gates of a large house. I pressed the button on the video phone as urgently as if I were dialing emergency services. A man replied tersely in one of those haughty voices that you reserve for unwanted callers.
Yes? What is it?
I crossed my fingers. Please let this guy take pity on me.
Good evening. So sorry to bother you, but I've crashed my car in the woods behind your house. My tires burst and I don't have any cell reception.
The buzzing sound of the gate being opened made me jump. Was it my bedraggled shipwreck survivor's appearance that had convinced him to offer me asylum? I didn't care. I slipped inside without a second thought and found myself confronted by a magnificent mansion, surrounded by a manicured garden. I felt as though I had struck gold. too. The light came on at the top of the front steps, and the door opened. A man's imposing silhouette advanced toward me, carrying an enormous umbrella. When he drew closer, I could make out a long face, good-looking despite the wrinkles. He was one of those men who had aged well, a kind of Gallic Sean Connery. I noticed dimples at the corners of his mouth, which gave him a friendly air, one that put me at ease. He was at least 60, but it didn't look as if it had taken much effort to get there. His pale gray eyes had a lively twinkle to them, and his salt and pepper hair was surprisingly thick for a man his age, only slightly receding in a way that suited the shape of his forehead. A beard, as well tended as the gardens, finished off his stylish appearance. He invited me to follow him inside.
"Come in, you're soaked through."
Thanks. It's really kind of you. Again, I'm so sorry to disturb you.
Don't be. It's not a problem. Take a seat while I fetch you a towel.
Just then, an elegant woman, who I guessed must be his wife, appeared. Her pretty face was creased with a frown, which she quickly suppressed when she saw me.
Is everything all right, darling?
Yes, everything's fine. This lady had a car accident and couldn't get a signal in the woods. She just needs to use the phone and to recover a little.
Oh, yes, of course.
When she saw how cold I was, she kindly offered me a cup of tea. I accepted on the spot. As she disappeared into the kitchen, her husband came back downstairs, holding a towel.
Thank you. You're very kind, Mr.
Call me Claude.
Ah, okay. My name's Camille.
Here you are, Camille. The phone is over there.
Oh, wonderful. I won't be a minute.
Take your time.
I went over to the telephone, which stood on a pretty inlaid wooden table beneath a piece of modern art. These people had taste, and they were obviously well off. What a relief I had come across them, and not some monster who devoured desperate housewives in distress. I picked up the receiver and dialed my insurance company's roadside assistance number. Since I couldn't give them my car's exact location, I asked the mechanic to come to the house, after Claude gave me the address. I was told they would be there within the hour. I breathed a sigh of relief. Things were looking up. Then I called home. Claude was considerate enough to go over to the fire crackling in the hearth on the far side of the room and poke the logs while I did so. After 8 seemingly endless rings, my husband picked up. I could tell from his voice that he had fallen asleep in front of the TV. He didn't seem surprised or worried that I was calling. He was used to me sometimes coming home quite late. I explained all the catastrophes that had occurred, but he kept interrupting me with annoyed grunts and tuts of exasperation before asking technical details. How long would it take the tow truck to come? How much was it going to cost? My nerves were frayed enough as it was, and the way he was behaving made me want to shout down the phone. Couldn't he show a bit of understanding just this once? After telling him that I would sort it out, and he needn't bother to wait up for me, I slammed down the phone. Despite myself, my hands were trembling, and I knew tears were welling in my eyes. I didn't hear Claude coming back over to me, so I jumped when I felt his hand on my shoulder.
Everything okay? Are you all right?
He asked gently. I only wished my husband's voice on the phone a few moments earlier had sounded as concerned. He bent over me and said again,
Are you okay?
At that, something in his face brought my defenses crashing down. My lip began to wobble, and I couldn't hold back the tears. My mascara ran down my face as I released all the pent-up frustration that had built over the previous hours, weeks, months, even. 3. At first, Claude said nothing. He simply stood there, one warm hand resting on my shoulder. When my tears finally dried, his wife, who in the meantime had put down a steaming cup of tea beside me, went to fetch some tissues. Then she vanished upstairs, no doubt sensing that her presence might inhibit what would be a welcome opportunity to get things off my chest.
I'm so sorry, This is ridiculous. I don't know what's come over me. I've been on edge recently anyway, and I've had such a terrible day. It's all too much. Claude had gone to sit in the armchair opposite me and was listening closely. Something about him made me feel I could trust him. He looked me straight in the eye. It was not a judgmental, intrusive look, more like a pair of open arms. Gazing at him, I sensed that I could open up. My inner resistance crumbled. So much the worse, or so much the better. I told him the main reasons why I felt so down. I explained how all the micro-frustrations had accumulated and eaten away at any enthusiasm I felt for life, just when it seemed I should have everything I needed to feel on top of the world. It's not that I'm unhappy, but I'm not especially happy either. It's so awful, this feeling that joy has slipped through my fingers. I don't want to see a doctor about it. He would probably tell me I was depressed and stuff me full of drugs. No. It's just this sort of dissatisfaction. It's nothing serious, but it's as if my heart simply isn't in it anymore. I'm sorry. I really don't know if any of this is making sense. What I said seemed to move him so much that I wondered if it hadn't struck a very personal chord. Although we had only met barely an hour before, a strange feeling of trust had sprung up between us. My confession had suddenly brought us several degrees closer and established a surprising bond. He obviously felt a genuine desire to comfort me.
Well, you may know what Abbé Pierre said. We have as much need of reasons for living as of the necessities of life. So don't say it's not serious. It's tremendously serious. Troubles of the soul are not something to be taken lightly. And listening to you, I actually think I know what's wrong.
You do? Really? I sniffled.
Yes.
He hesitated a moment before continuing, as if trying to work out whether I was going to be receptive to what he had to say. He must have decided I was, because he went on as though revealing a great secret.
You're probably suffering from a kind of acute routine-itis.
A what?
Acute routine-itis. It's a sickness of the soul that affects more and more people in the world, especially in the West. The symptoms are almost always the same. A lack of motivation, chronic dissatisfaction, feeling you've lost your bearings and everything meaningful in life. Finding it hard to feel happy, even though you have more than enough material goods, disenchantment, world weariness.
But how do you know all that?
I'm a routine-ologist.
A routine what? He must be used to this kind of reaction because he remained calm and collected while still projecting compassion. He briefly explained what routineology was, an innovative method still little known in France, but already popular in many other parts of the world. Researchers and scientists had come to realize that an increasing number of people were suffering from the syndrome. While not being clinically depressed, one could still have a feeling of emptiness and unease and suffer from the unpleasant sensation that although you had everything you needed to be happy, you didn't have the key to make the most of it. I listened to him, wide-eyed, drinking in what he was saying. It was such an accurate description of what I was feeling. My expression encouraged him to continue.
You know, at first glance, routine-itis may seem like a benign condition, but it can cause real damage, epidemics of pessimism, tsunamis of discontent, catastrophic storms of bad moods. Smiling could become endangered. Don't laugh, it's true. Not to mention the butterfly effect. The more the phenomenon spreads, the greater number of people fall prey to it. If not properly treated, routine-itis can lower the well-being index of an entire country.
Although I knew he was being serious, I also realized he was laying it on thick to bring a smile back to my face. Isn't that a bit of an exaggeration?
Only slightly. You can't imagine how many happiness illiterates there are. Not to mention all those lacking any emotional intelligence. It's a real scourge. Don't you agree that there's nothing worse than the sense that life is passing you by? Simply because you don't have the courage to go for what you really want? Because you haven't stayed faithful to your deepest seated values, to the dreams you harbored as a child?
Yes, that's so true.
Unfortunately, developing our capacity for being happy isn't something we're taught at school. Yet, there are techniques you can learn. You can have lots of money and be really unhappy, or equally not have much, but make your existence the sweetest there is. The capacity for being happy has to be worked on, built up day by day. All you have to do is take a good look at your system of values and re-educate the way you look at life and what's going on around you. He stood up and went over to the big table to fetch a plate of cookies to go with my tea. He nibbled a few, absent-mindedly, seemingly keen to return to our conversation. The more I listened to him telling me about how important it was to rediscover yourself, to love yourself better so as to find your own path and your happiness, to make that joy radiate around you, the more I wondered what on earth could have happened to him to make him so passionate about all this. He lit up completely as he tried to persuade me to share his conviction. Then all at once, he fell silent and stared at me with that benevolent look of his that seemed to read my mind as easily as a blind person reading Braille. You know, Camille, most things that happen to you depend on what goes on up here, he said, tapping his skull. In your head. The things that happen in the mind are full of surprises. You can't imagine just how far your thoughts influence your reality. Like Plato's description in his Allegory of the Cave. Chained up in a cave, mankind creates a false image of reality, because all he knows of it are the flickering images of the things that a fire lit behind him throws onto the wall in front. I couldn't help seeing the funny side of the situation, although I said nothing. I had to admit, I hadn't expected a philosophy lecture in such cozy surroundings only an hour after a car accident. You're comparing Plato's allegory to the way our minds function. Wow. He smiled at my reaction. Of course. I think there's a similarity with those thoughts that put a screen between reality and ourselves, distorting it with beliefs, presumptions, and prejudices. And who is doing all that? Your mind. Nothing but your mind. I call it the Thoughts Factory. It's a real assembly line. The good news is that you have the power to change those thoughts. It's up to you whether you see the glass as half empty or half full. You can work on your mindset so that it stops playing tricks on you. All you need is the method, a little patience, and perseverance. I was stunned. I didn't know whether he was raving mad or if I should wholeheartedly applaud his incredible pep talk. In the end, I did neither, simply nodding in agreement. He must have sensed that for the moment he had reached the limit of the information I could digest. I'm sorry. Do you find my theories annoying?
No, not at all. They sound really interesting. It's just that I'm a bit tired. Don't take any notice of me.
Of course, that's only natural. If you like, I could talk to you again about this method another time. It's really been proved to help people recover a sense of purpose and rebuild a fulfilling life for themselves.
He stood up and went over to a pretty little cherrywood writing desk. He took out a business card and handed it to me.
Come and see me whenever you like, he said, smiling softly.
I read, Claude Dupontel, Routineologist, 15 Rue de la Boissy, 75008, Paris. The card also had his cell and landline. I took it from him without really knowing what to make of all this yet. To be polite, I told him I'd think about it. This didn't seem to faze him, and he didn't insist. As a salesperson, that surprised me. Didn't anyone who was self-employed jump at the chance to secure a new client? The fact that he was not at all pushy seemed to me to indicate a rare self-confidence. It made me feel that if I turned down his offer, I would be the one losing out. But at that moment, I was still feeling the effect of everything that had happened that evening. The stupid accident, the stupid storm, like something out of a bad horror movie. And on top of it all, a routine-ologist. I thought I'd started imagining things. In the next 5 minutes, the camera crew would appear and someone would shout, "Gotcha!" The doorbell rang, but it wasn't a cameraman or a TV presenter, just the tow truck guy.
"Would you like us to come with you?" Claude asked.
"No, thanks so much. I'll be fine. You've already been very kind. I don't know how to thank you."
"It was nothing. Anyone would have done the same. Send us a text when you get home."
"I will. Goodbye and thanks again." I climbed up into the cab with the mechanic to show him the way, taking a last look back through the truck window. I saw Claude and his wife standing on the steps arm in arm, waving a brief goodbye. They seemed such a loving, sharing couple. With this image of peaceful happiness etched into my mind, we bumped off into the darkness, back to reality. 4. I woke up the next morning with a terrible migraine that lasted all day. I had spent the night tossing and turning, thinking over everything Claude Dupontel had told me. Was I really a victim of acute routine-itis? Did the anxiety that had held me in its grip for several weeks now really mean I had to embark on a course of counseling? What, in fact, did I really have to complain about? I had a husband, and a son, and a job that offered me security. Maybe I just needed to pull myself together and stop wallowing. And yet, my 30-something middle-class discontent wouldn't let me go. I had tried often enough to sweep it under the carpet without success. I did occasionally try to put things into perspective, to see the bigger picture, as they say in women's magazines. I ran through the whole gamut of human misery in my mind. People in war zones, people with serious illnesses, the homeless, jobless, loveless. Compared to them, my problems seemed so petty. But as Claude Dupontel had said, there was no point comparing what couldn't be compared. The scale of happiness or misery isn't the same for everyone. I didn't know him, and yet he seemed so well-adjusted, so centered. Yes, centered was the word. Of course, I didn't believe in miracle cures that transform your life with the wave of a magic wand. But he seemed so convincing when he said that things really could change. He insisted that feeling down and stuck in a rut was not inevitable. That you can choose to be someone who does not allow daily existence to grind her down, but who lives life to the full. To turn your life into a work of art. It was a project that seemed pretty unrealistic at first, but why not at least try to aim toward it? In theory, I was all for it. But in practice? "One day I'll go to live in theory, because in theory, everything is wonderful." So, how to get started? To get beyond the stage of shoulda, coulda, woulda? With all this playing on my mind, I struggled out of bed. I felt as though I'd been beaten black and blue during the night. To top it all off, without meaning to, I put my left foot on the floor first. I know it's a silly superstition, but I immediately saw this as a bad omen. The instinctive reaction of a brain swamped with negative vibes. The day was off to a bad start. Sebastian, my alleged nearest and dearest, hardly even bothered to say good morning. He wrestled with a disobedient tie, and in between his stifled swearing, I thought I made out that he was late for a meeting. So, he wasn't going to be taking Adrienne to school today either. Sigh. Adrienne, my son, is 9 years, 6 months, 10 days, and 8 hours old, as he would be only too happy to inform you. I found his rush to grow up both touching and slightly terrifying. It was all moving so quickly. too quickly. Adrian had always done everything faster than usual. The only way to have stopped him would have been to tie him to a chair. We soon had to get used to the idea that our son was an energizer bunny. He never wore out. But I did. Even though I loved him more than anything in the world, there were days when I thought he must have a mini energy-sucking vacuum cleaner under his t-shirt. Of course, we were modern parents. We'd practically been weaned on the belief that the child is a fully-fledged individual with a right to be heard. But experience had taught us that our way of bringing him up had been far too liberal. By sticking to the ideals of dialogue and respect for a child's personality, we had given our son far too much freedom. "Boundaries!" my mother never stopped yelling at me. She was right, of course. Boundaries, that was what I had been trying to establish for several months now, in an attempt to correct our overlax attitude. I had done a U-turn and gone from one extreme to the other. No doubt I was now being too tough on him, but you just do your best, don't you? I was constantly whining at Adrian in an effort to keep him in line. He would whine back, but comply in the end. In spite of his rebellious side, deep down, he was a good kid. I knew I was on his back a lot, for his own good, I was sure, although at times I felt I was turning into a real nag. I hated being like that. "Tidy your room. Take a shower. Switch the lights off. Do your homework. Put the toilet seat down." I had exchanged my good mum approach for the bad mum one. And everything I had gained in neatly folded socks had been lost in terms of my relationship with him. There was a tug of war going on between us. We were cat and dog, as if we no longer understood each other. Then again, how could he act like such a teenager when he wasn't even 10 yet? All this was going through my head when I walked into his room. We had to leave the house in 10 minutes, and he was playing ping-pong against the wall, only half-dressed. He had put on odd socks, hadn't bothered to comb his hair, and his bedroom looked as though a bomb had gone off in it. Not that he had noticed. He looked at me with his chestnut brown eyes and their astonishingly long lashes, as enchanting as ever. I paused for a moment to consider his round face and strong features, his well-defined mouth, which was now stuck in a stubborn pout. Even when it was this untidy, his hair was so lovely and soft, it made you want to stroke it. He was a gorgeous little devil. I resisted the temptation to go and hug him and smooth it down, the rascal. I was the drill sergeant, determined to make sure he was in step. "But Mom, what's your problem? Stay cool. Chill out," he replied, underlining his words with a zen rapper hand gesture he'd learned from the latest YouTube clip. That drove me crazy. I yelled at him and then slammed into the bathroom for a shower. I washed hastily, already dreading what was on the day's to-do list. As I stepped out of the shower, my reflection in the mirror only made me frown more. A deep furrow was plowed across my forehead. I stared at this face that used to be pretty, and maybe still could be if my skin weren't so sallow and the bags under the green eyes that had once been so seductive weren't so dark, just as could my blonde silky hair when I found the time to style it properly to frame my round face. A little too round these days, due to the weight I'd put on after my pregnancy and the sweet treats I had given in to in the years since then. Annoyed, I grabbed the lifeline of mother's little helpers and swallowed far too quickly, considering their expiration date. By now, I was in a thoroughly bad mood. As I rushed back into the bedroom to get dressed, I carelessly knocked over the photo frame on the bedside table. I picked it up to put it back. It was a great photo of me and Sebastian, at a time when we would stargaze and laugh all night long. What had happened to that handsome man, with flashing eyes who knew just what to whisper in my ear to make me go weak at the knees? How long had it been since he had made the slightest attempt to seduce me? And yet, he was a good, kind man. Really kind. Thinking about the tenderness that had slowly and subtly replaced the passion of our early days, I felt vaguely sick. Over the years, the once wild, lush jungle of our love for each other had been transformed into a formal French garden, everything neat and tidy, with not a single blade of grass out of place. Shouldn't love spill out, burst into flame, boil over, erupt uncontrollably? Anyway, that was how things were now. What had been the tipping point? When Adrienne had come on the scene? When Sebastian had been promoted? Who knew? Whatever the reason, the outcome was the same. Stuck in this marital mud, hemmed in by an existence that ran along too smoothly, I realized that our life as a couple had, like a piece of chewing gum you've chewed for too long, lost all its flavor. Chasing away these unpleasant thoughts with a wave of the hand, I threw on the first thing I could find. Who cared about grace or elegance? Who would they be for? And why? Ever since I'd entered into a partnership for life, I was no longer of interest to anyone. Might as well be comfortable. I dropped off my son at school, nagging him all the way to hurry. Hurrying was the huge bugbear of all our lives. It laid down the law, punished us like an all-powerful tyrant, and made us submit to the crushing power of the hands on the clock face. You had only to look at those people ready to crush others in order to cram onto an already packed metro car because they can't bear to wait for the next train in 3 minutes, or who run a red light to save a few seconds at the risk of a serious accident, or talk on the phone while they are tapping away at a computer and eating at the same time. I was no different. Since I had no car after the accident, I ran to the metro and almost went flying down the stairs. Great idea, Camille. Break a leg just so you don't miss your train. Out of breath, sweating freely despite the cold, I collapsed onto a seat, wondering how on earth I was going to get through the day ahead of me. 5. When I left Claude Dupontel's house a week earlier, I had slipped his card into my coat pocket. Every day since then, I had felt it, turning it over and over, without ever making up my mind to call him. It was only on the 9th day, as I was coming out of a heated meeting where my boss had told me off in front of everyone, that I decided this couldn't go on. Things had to change. I didn't really know how or where to start, but I suspected that if anyone did, it would be Claude. I called him during my lunch break. My stomach was still churning from that morning's meeting. The phone rang several times before he picked up. Mr. Dupontel?
Speaking?
It's Camille. Do you remember me?
Of course. Good morning, Camille. How are you?
Good, thank you. Well, actually, not all that good. That's why I'm calling.
Oh, yes?
You offered to tell me a bit more about your happiness method. I'm really interested in it, so if you're free.
Let's see. Would this Friday at 7 p.m. be any good?
I quickly wondered what I could do about Adrienne and decided that he could stay home alone for a while, just until his father got back from work. Okay, I can manage that. Thanks so much. I'll see you on Friday, then.
See you on Friday, Camille. Take care.
Take care. The words were still echoing in my mind as I walked back to the office. It was so nice to have someone be concerned about me. An ounce of kindness in a world of selfish bores, a world I knew very well, as I was the only woman in a team of 8 salespeople. The insults flew round the office all day, schoolboy humor that was often cruel. I found it exhausting. I really wanted something different, for relationships to be more honest, perhaps. Of course, I was very pleased to have a job at all. Nowadays, having a permanent position was a luxury, as my mother never ceased telling me. Ah, my mother. My father had left her soon after I was born, and even if he hadn't completely vanished, he occasionally sent her money. She had struggled to get by as a single mother, and had always given me the impression she was hard up. So when the moment came for me to choose a career, there was no option except to go down whatever path she thought would be the most profitable. something that would be lucrative, so that I would be financially independent whatever happened. I had always been passionate about drawing, but I had to put aside my creative ideas and force myself to enroll in a business studies course. I had found my career path, on the surface at least, but inside me, something wasn't right. Consigning your childhood dream to the garbage is a sure way to put your heart out of joint. The day I graduated was without doubt the happiest day of my mother's life, apart from when I was born. I was going to have a brighter future than hers. Her joy was a balm for my misgivings, so that in the end I persuaded myself that things weren't so bad. My career started very well. I was good with other people. Then my marriage and Adrienne's birth put a break on my ambitions. I decided to go part-time to be able to enjoy my son. I naively thought this was the best solution, without realizing all the drawbacks, apart from having to do in 4 days what others did in 5, I got the distinct impression that I had fallen in the estimation of my colleagues and superiors. I was devalued in a way I thought was unfair. My permanent job had coincided with a permanent relationship. 12 years plain sailing, with a few ups and downs, of course, but no great storms. On the verge of turning 40, 38 and a quarter, to be precise, my God, why did those grains of sand seem to slip faster and faster through the hourglass? I had achieved a reasonable amount. A husband who had stayed with me. I had apparently escaped the family curse of the abandoned wife, but I occasionally felt it was hanging over me like the sword of Damocles. A wonderful child. Wasn't his boisterousness simply a sign of how he was thriving? And a job that more than fulfilled its purpose in terms of financial rewards, with the added bonus from time to time of enabling me to secure a client of my own. So everything was more or less all right. More or less. And it was precisely this, more or less, that made me so keen to go and see Claude Dupontel. A simple more or less that concealed some big whys, and brought with it a whole series of reassessments, as I was about to discover. On the day of our appointment, I found myself outside an elegant 19th-century stone building with cast-iron balconies and decorated mouldings. A caryatid seemed to look askance at me as I went in through a big doorway and reached a luxurious vestibule. I was so intimidated I almost crept into the interior courtyard, which was beautifully paved and filled with a whole range of stylish greenery, a haven in the urban jungle.
"The first door on the left at the far end of the courtyard," Claude Dupontel had told me.
No sooner had I rung the bell than a small, slender woman opened the door, as if she had been behind it, waiting for me.
"Are you Camille?" she asked directly with a broad smile.
Yes, that's me," I replied, slightly taken aback. She asked me to follow her down a long corridor. I had the impression she was shooting curious, amused glances at me. As we passed a mirror, I couldn't help checking to make sure my lipstick wasn't smudged and that there was nothing odd about what I was wearing. I couldn't see anything wrong. She left me in a waiting room, filled with soft, deep chairs, telling me that Mr. Dupontel would see me in a moment. I became absorbed in the modern art decorating the walls, enjoying the intertwined shapes and subtle play of colors. The assistant reappeared a few minutes later with another client. A young woman who I guessed could be no more than 30 sat in an armchair on my left, a stylish brunette. I envied her svelte figure and chic appearance. Catching me looking at her, she smiled.
"Do you have an appointment with Claude?"
"Yes."
"Is this your first time?"
"Yes."
"You'll see, he's extraordinary. He's worked miracles with me. Of course, his method is a little surprising at first. But then..."
She leaned over toward me, obviously intending to go on. But at that moment, the door opened, and Claude Dupontel appeared.
"Ah, Sophie, there you are. Good evening, Camille. We'll only be a second. We just have to deal with something briefly, and then I'll be with you."
The young woman, called Sophie, jumped up as though Claude was someone she would follow to the ends of the earth. I heard her laughter tinkle along the corridor. They seemed to get on like a house on fire. The door to his office closed behind them. It opened again shortly afterward, and once again I heard her tinkling laugh. Now it was my turn. I stealthily wiped my hand on my coat, hoping to get rid of the telltale traces of moisture. How stupid to get nervous because I was visiting him like this. I was only curious.
Gomil, come with me. It's along here.
I followed him into his office, which was again surprisingly elegant.
Please, take a seat. I'm delighted to see you, he said with a smile that matched his words. If you're here, it must be because you want to change certain things in your life. Is that right?
Yes. At least I think so. What you told me the other day really intrigued me, and I'd like to know more.
Briefly, I need to warn you that it's not a conventional counseling method, in the sense that it takes more of a practical approach than a theoretical one. We start from the principle that it's not within these walls that anyone who wishes to change will discover the truth or understand the meaning of her life. No, it's only through action, through actual experience. Apart from that, the method draws on the teachings of several schools of philosophical, spiritual, and even scientific thought. It adopts the most tried and tested personal development techniques from all around the world. It's a summary of what mankind has found most useful in order to evolve positively.
Okay, I get it. Understanding the meaning of life. That resonates with me, of course. But isn't that what we all want?
It's like the Holy Grail, but it's incredibly hard to find, and I've no idea where to start looking. Don't worry. Giving your life meaning is the common thread of all change. In practice, you advance stage by stage.
Stage by stage?
Yes. It's obvious that you don't become a black belt of change overnight. That's why I apply the theory of small steps to help my clients progress gradually. When we talk of change, lots of people imagine something huge and radical. But decisive life changes start with small, apparently insignificant transformations. It may be that sometimes my advice sounds self-evident, almost too obvious. But make no mistake, it's not managing to do things once that's complicated. It's doing them every day. We are what we repeat over and over, according to Aristotle. That's so true. To become a better, happier, more balanced person calls for regular work and effort. You'll find that the difficulty isn't knowing what you ought to be doing to feel better, but to commit yourself completely and to move from theory to practice.
And what makes you believe I'm capable of it at all?
I'm not the one who has to believe it. You do. But rather than asking yourself if you're capable of being happier, start by asking yourself if you really want it. Do you, Camille?
Yes. Yes, I think so.
He smiled kindly, then asked me to come and look at the clippings pinned to the wall near his desk. I joined him. There were photographs of happy people, apparently enjoying whatever it was they most wanted to do, postcards sent from far-flung, exotic locations, all kinds of thank you notes.
Just like you, all these people had their doubts at the outset. It's only normal, to begin with. What you need is to really want to take the leap. Do you feel motivated to change, Camille?
I try to delve into my innermost feelings. Yes, yes, I do. Even if it scares me a little, I really want things to change. But how? That's what I'm not clear about.
That's typical. To help you have a better idea, are you willing to carry out a little exercise that doesn't commit you to anything and will only take a few minutes?
Yes, why not?
Good. Then I'd like you to write down everything you'd like to change in your life. And I mean everything. From the most trivial to the most essential. Is that okay?
Yes, of course.
He sat me down at a small writing desk in a corner of the room, where sheets of paper and pens of all kinds were waiting for the candidates for a better life.
"I'll leave you to it. I'll be back in a minute," he said, smiling encouragement.
I found this a fairly simple exercise. I spooled through the film of my life and began to note down anything that occurred to me. I was pleased to see how easily the ideas flowed, but rather less happy to realize how long my list was becoming. As I wrote, I became aware of all the frustrations that had been building up, and it came as a shock. When Claude Dupontel reappeared, he had the good grace not to raise his eyebrows at the length of my list. All he said was, "That's very good." I couldn't help but feel that little stab of joy that schoolgirls get when they are praised by their teacher. But then I thought, that's nonsense. There's really no reason to be so happy that you've got such a long list of frustrations. He must have read my mind, because he said, to reassure me,
"You can be proud of yourself. It's very hard to be brave enough to put down on paper everything that seems wrong with your life. You should congratulate yourself."
I have difficulty being proud of myself in general.
That's something that can soon be changed.
From where I sit, that's hard to believe.
Yet it's the very first thing I'm going to ask of you, Camille. To believe that. Are you ready for it?
Oh, yes, I think so. Well, I mean, yes, I'm sure.
That's the spirit. Change is a door that can only be opened from the inside, as the saying goes. Which means, Camille, that you are the only one who can decide to change. I can help you, but I need you to be totally committed.
What do you mean by totally committed? I asked, vaguely disturbed.
Simply that you become completely involved in the process. Don't worry, nothing I propose will ever be dangerous or more than you can manage. We'll work together within an ethical framework that respects how you are progressing. The only objective is to help you make those positive breakthroughs that will lead to change.
What if at some point I decide I don't like the method?
You're under no obligation to continue. If you want to stop, you can. But if you decide to continue, I'll ask you to commit yourself 400%. That's how the best results are achieved.
How long does this kind of counseling last,
as a rule? However long it takes someone to refashion his or her life project so that it brings happiness.
I see. One last question. You haven't said how much all this costs. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to afford it.
As far as money goes, routinology operates in a very special, even unique manner, but one that's been proved to work. You will only pay me what you think you owe me, and then only when you have succeeded. If my method fails, and you're not satisfied, you won't have to pay a thing.
What? But that's completely crazy. How do you make a living like that? And how can you be sure that people will be honest enough to pay you someday?
That's the way you see the world at the moment, Camille. But I can assure you that because I have faith in things like trust, shared knowledge, and unconditional support, the people I've helped have been more than generous once they have achieved their goals. I believe in every person's potential to succeed, as long as they show respect for their own nature and most cherished values. All you have to do is make your life project properly fit in with who you are. That demands a real commitment and a lot of effort. You will have to be methodical about it, but it's worth it.
Have you ever failed?
Never. Right, we can stop here for today. I'll let you think all this over at your leisure. One option would be for you to embark on the first stage to see what you think of it. If you get results, you carry on. If not, you stop.
I'll think about it. Thank you, Claude. He led me back to the door and gave me a firm handshake, that of someone who knows what he wants in life. I envied him. I'll let you have my decision very soon. Goodbye, Claude.
Take your time. Goodbye, Camille.
6. Outside in the street once more, I felt like a stranger to myself. The interview had turned my world upside down. My hands were trembling a little, but I didn't know whether it was from fear or excitement. As I walked toward the metro, thoughts were racing through my brain. With every step I took, I recalled the things that Claude had said, and my determination grew.
Everyone has a duty toward life, don't you think? To learn to know ourselves, to become aware that time is short, to make choices that matter and that mean something. And above all, not to waste our talents. We must fulfill our potential, Camille, urgently.
That evening, I went over what my life was at present. It was all very comfy, a safe job, a safe love life. But that was simply window dressing. It was high time that I took a proper look at what was underneath and assumed responsibility for it. As a mother, things were tense. Recently, that tension between my son and me had become electric. Everything was a chore. What with his school, his clubs and hobbies, and medical appointments, it felt as if I no longer had a minute to myself. As soon as I set foot inside our front door, I felt harassed, and my tolerance threshold dropped dramatically. I flew off the handle at next to nothing, especially over homework, which had tripled that school year thanks to an overzealous teacher. Already tired from school, Adrienne saw this workload as punishment. It seemed endless, and I felt I was dragging him along like a dead donkey. I shouted at him. He exploded back at me, either bursting into tears or becoming hysterical. I was so exhausted by it all that once he had finally completed his work, I would let him do whatever he wanted, and he would rush off to plonk himself in front of a screen. I knew that this was the easy way out, but I needed a bit of peace to unwind for 5 minutes. "It's only human, isn't it?" I would reassure myself. Often, he would want me to come and look at the imaginary world he had created on Minecraft, his favorite computer game of the moment, or an unmissable YouTube video. "I don't have the time, sweet pea. I have to get supper ready." That was how it was. Over the past few months, I hadn't had the energy to take an interest in his world, and without properly realizing it, this had created a gulf between us. He would wander off again, disappointed and vaguely sad.
"You never do anything with me anymore," he would say reproachfully.
I struggled to justify myself. "Adrienne, try to understand. You're a big boy now. The house doesn't run itself. Besides, with all the games you have..."
"But I have no one to play them with. Why can't you give me a little brother?"
There he went, making me feel guilty again. Why, as a modern European woman, should I be obliged to have 2.4 children? What if I wanted only one? Social pressure. That got on my nerves as well. All year round, my ears were filled with the same old refrain. "It's so sad to be an only child. He must get bored." Sebastian had been disappointed when I confessed I didn't want any more children. Had that also contributed to the distance between us? That and the daily routine? The draining effect of monotony, of the ordinary. We no longer feel obliged to make an effort, so in the end we stop making any effort at all. We just grow careless. It's so obvious, right under our noses, and yet we don't see it. I had reached this stage in my reflections when I glanced over at my husband. He was stretched out on the sofa, half watching TV while he played on his smartphone. He was oblivious to my presence, and above all to my inner turmoil. That did it. Yes, at that instant I knew that I wanted to stop settling for this nice little existence that had become such a rut it no longer had any meaning. I wanted to have the courage to shake up everything that was so well established, so predictable, so settled. Exchange the reassuring for the exhilarating. In other words, to press the reset button and start all over again. I tapped out a text message to Claude Dupontel, and immediately pressed send, like someone drawing up a ladder behind her to make sure there is no going back. If I thought any more about all this, there was a risk that I might back out. "I've made my mind up to give your method a try. I've nothing to lose, have I?" Half an hour later, I jumped when I heard my mobile ping.
Bravo for taking this first step, Camille. It's always the hardest, but I'm sure you won't regret it. Keep an eye on your mailbox. You'll be receiving my first instructions by post. Take care, Claude.
I was pleased, excited, nervous, all three at once. I spent a restless night dreaming I was heading down a ski slope at breakneck speed. I was elated until I suddenly realized that however hard I tried, there was no way I could stop. I woke up covered in sweat and paralyzed with fear. I was so anxious to get home and open my letterbox that the workday seemed endless. What a disappointment. It was empty.
Don't be so impatient. You're hardly his first priority.
Next day, the box was empty again. Another disappointment. It's not even been 48 hours. The day after, empty. I was champing at the bit. My excitement had turned to frustration. When was I going to start, for heaven's sake? After 8 days of feverish waiting, I gave in and telephoned Claude. His assistant answered with that dreamy voice of hers, seemingly designed to calm all expressions of impatience.
I'm sorry, Mr. Dupontel is in meetings all day. May I give him a message?
Oh, yes, thanks. I'd like to know when my course is to start.
What did he say the last time you saw him?
To await his instructions, which I'd received by post.
If that's what he said, then you only have to wait. Goodbye. Have a good day.
This time, her mellifluous voice really wound me up. I hung up, furious, in such a state that I was ready to tear up the first thing I could lay my hands on. 7. 3 days later, I finally received the letter I had been so eagerly awaiting. I had been patient for 11 days. I felt the slightly lumpy envelope, trying desperately to guess what it contained. Inside, I found a chain that I immediately recognized as a charm necklace. An adorable little white lotus pendant was attached to it. I quickly unfolded the short letter from Claude.
Hello, Camille. I'm so pleased you've decided to take this first step toward reconquering your life. I have total confidence in you and wish you the best of luck in reaching your goals. To welcome and encourage you, I'm giving you this first charm, a white lotus. Each time you've made decisive progress, reached a level of change, you will receive a new lotus charm in a different color. As in martial arts, the color code depends on the level you have reached. White for a beginner, then yellow, green, purple, up to the black lotus, which means you have reached the final stage of change. That will signify you have attained all your objectives.
Delighted with the idea, I twisted the pendant between my fingers, then read on.
These past few days, without you realizing it, your initiation has already started and has taught you the first lesson. Never simply wait for something to happen. You have spent your time watching out for my instructions, for me to tell you what to do, yet you could already have begun to act on your own behalf. Just remember, Camille, you're the one and only person who can change your life. The impetus has to come from you. I'll be your guide, but I won't do anything for you. Write this sentence on a post-it and look at it every day. I am the only one responsible for my life and happiness. Now here is your first task. You are going to carry out a complete spring clean inside and out. By this I mean, first, an inner cleanup. You must identify everything about you that seems toxic, negative, that hampers your relationships and the way you organize your life. I call it personal ecology. At the same time, you need to have an external spring clean of the things in your home. You are to throw away at least 10 useless objects and to tidy up, sort out, and refresh your surroundings in every way possible. Bring me photos of this the next time we meet. You have 2 weeks to do this. Meanwhile, you can of course...